Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two. Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Have you seen 4LO magazine yet? 4LO magazine is a high-quality, well-written, four-wheel drive-focused magazine for the enthusiast market. If you still love the idea of a printed magazine, something to save and read at any time, 4LO is the magazine for you. 4LO cannot be found in stores, but you can have it delivered to your home or place of business. Visit 4LOmagazine.com to order your subscription today. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, I'll be talking with a guy that won a world championship in speed skiing. Yeah, that's downhill speed skiing, like on big mountains and snow. And has now found a love of rock crawling and hopes to win a championship in Unlimited. Yep, that's John Hemble. John Hemble, it is so good to talk to you. Saw you just a couple weeks ago at Cedar City, and we discussed doing this podcast, and it's really good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
So let's jump right in, and I know you've got an extensive background in competing, not necessarily all in rock crawling. So let's get started with where were you born and raised?
Well, I'm not sure where I was born is worth mentioning, but Worcester, Massachusetts, and I stayed for 5 days. So
5 days in West Mass, huh?
5 whole days in Worcester, Mass. So, spent a little bit of time in Florida up until about second grade. Had some family, mom's family down there, and spent a bunch of time with grandma and grandpa. Lived in their house for quite a while, and had a very close family. It was great.
Excellent. And what precipitated the move? Was it work related for parents or something?
Worcester, Mass. Just my mom was a single mom and okay. Spending time with her godparents. And when her parents found out that she was pregnant and not on drugs, they invited her back home and said, please come and we welcome you. And, you know, we're glad you're not doing worse things in the world. So she was welcomed home with open arms, and for a Catholic family, an unwed mother was a big deal, particularly, you know, late 60s.
Yeah, I understand. I grew up in a Catholic family. Well, my mom walked away from the Catholic Church in the 60s. I think it was about the time she decided to burn her bra.
Well, my mom was slated to be a nun, so that didn't work out when I came along.
yeah, I guess not.
So, the family welcomed us back with open arms, and mom kind of let them help out with raising me for a little while since she was a single mom, and so I grew up in grandma and grandpa's home for quite a while, and they were a great family to have around. I had several older aunts and uncles and lived with some of them for a while, so they're more like my brothers and sisters. And it was and still is a very close family.
That's really good to hear. Family is important.
It is. And when I was about 5 years old, my mom met who is now my father, and he adopted me when I was 7 when they got married. And he's been a great role model, and I really appreciate him being in my life and showing us all the world and lots of different things and giving us lots of opportunities and moved us to Aspen, Colorado when I was very young, and like third grade, I think I started living in Aspen, Colorado, and fell in love with skiing for sure. So that was one of the first things I competed in. It became a career after a while, but not until I was an adult. So we'll get to that eventually.
Right. And so what was school like? So your third grade thereabouts, you're moving from Florida to Aspen, a little bit of culture change there.
Little bit of culture shock. Yeah, I was young enough to not really, have it affect me too much. Right. Made friends pretty quickly. And I was younger than almost everybody in my class all the way through school. I started first grade when I was 5 years old. My birthday's in March. So, most of the kids in my class were at least a year older than me. So, I don't know. I guess I was smart when I was 5 years old, and I never looked back.
Right. Cool. So you're telling me you're smart?
Oh, no, I was when I was five. I don't know what happened after that.
So then what was school like for you growing up? Was it easy? Was it or were you one of those guys that, looked out the window and just wanted to be outside instead?
I definitely wanted to be doing other things. When I applied myself, I did very, very well in school. I think, when those challenges arise and you say, I'm going to meet that challenge, you can do great things. And it was hard for me to really focus. I put things off typically. And but once I really set my mind to it, I did really well in school. And fortunately, Aspen had a very good school system. It attracted some of the best teachers in the world, more the culture there and the lifestyle, extremely expensive place to live, but, you could, if you could figure out how to make a living there, it was a great place to be.
Right. And what made the family move there? Did Dad have a job going into that, or?
So my mom, went to work for Delta Airlines when I was very young, and that's where she met my dad. He was a pilot. She was a flight attendant.
Okay.
They fell in love, and he could pretty much live wherever, he wanted. So he fell in love with the Aspen Snowmass area, loved to ski out there, started skiing there when Snowmass was first opened in the late 60s, and, had been skiing there pretty much every year until we moved there in about 74, 75, something like that. And it was very difficult, I think, for them as parents to live there. We made it work, but they both worked out of Atlanta, Georgia. And so, Delta didn't even fly to Colorado in the 70s. So it was very, very difficult. They had to take whoever Brand X was. Back then it was Eastern or Continental or, a lot of different airlines. They would have to fly somewhere from Denver to where Delta flew, and then get on a plane there and get to Atlanta to go to work.
Wow.
And so I learned how to fend for myself very young. I had a job after school when I was, single digits, making a couple bucks an hour under the table. It wasn't actually legal to work, but I didn't mind working for what I wanted. So I was able to pay for my own skiing on the weekends. It was a few dollars to get a ski pass as a student. It wasn't much, but it was something that, I wanted to do. And, even though mom and dad would leave money with a couple older step siblings, I never saw that money. So,
right. Yeah. This is so that, John can, do what he needs to do and get fed, and you got the hot dogs?
I don't remember a whole lot of the food, honestly. I just remember a lot of work growing up and really enjoying it. I worked in a in a ski shop in Snowmass, Colorado, on after school, just kind of cleaning up after the daily rentals. Back then, rentals didn't seem to last for a week. They lasted maybe a day. And so at the end of the day, all the skis and boots and poles would come back, and there'd be a huge pile in the middle of the ski shop. And it was my job to pair them all up together, whatever miscellaneous items were there, pair them up, put them away, check the skis. If they needed to be tuned, they went to the shop. If they just needed to be put back away, they got hung on the rack.
Right.
And then, you know, disinfect the boots and do all that. It's like being in a bowling alley.
Right. So then working in the ski shop, separating stuff, piles of, you know, matching skis, matching poles, boots, rentals, probably gloves, everything, right?
A little bit of everything. You know, clothing wasn't a deal, but, you know, all the hard goods, skis, boots, poles, that was a big deal. And putting that all away and then vacuuming the shop at the end of the day. And, you know, like I said, I got a couple bucks an hour under the table and made some really good lifelong friends, honestly. The manager of the ski shop, the owner, several owners, a bunch of brothers owned the ski shop, and still friends of mine to this day. So it's great.
Awesome. And with going to school there, was skiing the only thing, or were there other, did you participate in anything else?
When I was there, you know, there was always stuff in school, track and, you know, different field events and things like that, but wasn't real big into that. I wasn't any, you know, the ball sports really didn't interest me very much. But we did, you know, personal things interested me, skateboarding, BMX, that sort of thing. And, unfortunately I wasn't able to stay in Aspen. My parents decided after quite a while that, you know, it wasn't worth the work that they were going through to be able to live that lifestyle. And so they moved us just before I was in high school. They moved us to pretty close to Atlanta, Georgia, just south of there in Peachtree City.
Okay.
Which was a big airline town. It was pretty much filled up with airline personnel of some sort. And there were a lot of outdoor activities there as well. I got into soccer and competitive BMX and a few other things, but bicycles became a big thing for me for a while, and I competed both state level and national level at that. And
BMX, you said?
BMX, and then BMX freestyle. I was on a couple of teams doing freestyle stuff, jumps, ground tricks, all kinds of, you know, ramp stuff. So anything that had to do with a bike. And, you know, sometimes on the weekends I'd get my road bike and I'd go for, you know, 120 mile ride on my road bike. So whatever, you know, whatever it took to get out there and stay fit, be happy, I was doing it. And then the last couple of years of high school, soccer became a bigger thing. I started playing soccer pretty much right when we moved to Georgia, and got pretty good, played for, you know, some of the city teams at first, and then tried out for the county classic team, which is all the best players in the county, and, you know, hundreds of kids try out, and I got on that team. And then between that team and then playing for my high school, I was playing, oh, pretty much at least five days a week for one team or the other. And when I wasn't practicing with one team, I was practicing with or playing with the other team. And so they seemed to be okay with it. They said, as long as you're out there practicing and, you know, doing a good job and, you know, you're helping us win, then that's great. And we never played each other, so that wasn't a big deal.
Right, because what you were on was more like a club team.
It was more like a club team, exactly. And then, you know, the high school team was playing other high schools. And
right.
That was kind of another big thing. You know, we had a very, very small high school, so soccer was our big sport.
Okay. And then the club team probably had other high school guys that you played in high school probably on the team as well.
I never actually saw anybody on that team or playing against that I saw playing in my high school.
Okay.
Just it seemed like it was totally different people. Georgia had a lot of different soccer teams and a whole lot of schools. So
right.
My high school was actually a private school, kindergarten through 12th grade. The schools in Georgia at that time were ranked somewhere around 47th in the nation. So the private school was about the only way I was going to get anything close to the education I was getting in Aspen.
Right. Okay. And, or when did you start driving and what did you start driving?
Well, that was one of the things in high school that was tough for me because I was much younger than everybody else in my class, at least. Everybody started driving well before me. Fortunately, I was always dating some girl who was older than me, so I always had a ride. But
perfect. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that at all. Yeah, started driving, you know, obviously at 16 was, you know, my dad wasn't too keen on me driving prior to that. He was always pretty strict about those rules and what was set as far as society. And so I didn't really get a chance to drive much before the age of 15 and then you know, drive solo at 16. But first thing I actually drove, I want to say was a Mazda B2200, which was like a Ford Courier truck, exactly the same body style as the Ford Courier. Mine was a long bed and it was diesel. Mazda B2000 was a gas truck. The B2200 was a diesel. And great little truck, got phenomenal mileage, but man, was it small.
Right.
and drove that until I started college after the first year of college. And I bought a 1985 Toyota SR5 pickup. So, you know, extra cab, just, you know, something. It was actually only a year old when I bought it, so it was pretty new to me. It had about 30,000 miles on it, and it was a great truck, you know, solid front axle. I'm glad I didn't get the 86 because the 86 had independent front suspension.
Right.
But I was able to lift it pretty easily and, you know, put a little bit bigger tires on it and go out wheeling.
And you started wheeling. Where did you go to college?
I went to college at Florida State University, not too far from where I was in Atlanta. It was about 3.5 to 4 hours from Atlanta. I had some family who went to Florida State, an aunt and an uncle who actually met there. And I checked out the school and really liked it. I looked at a couple other schools. I actually got a soccer scholarship to a school in Mississippi, but I didn't really like the school, so I didn't take it. I looked at Florida State. I looked at Auburn, looked at a couple other schools, thought about going back to Colorado for college. Logistics were a little too difficult for me. I wanted to stick around and, you know, be closer to family and be closer to friends that I had made over that, you know, basically 5 years of being in Georgia. So it was kind of nice to be close to there. And Florida State was a great school.
Right. Seminoles.
Seminoles and beyond. Beyond that, it was like 5.5 girls to every guy when I started there. So
really?
There was that.
Well, it's like the opposite of Alaska.
Yeah. Florida State used to be an all-girls school once upon a time.
Oh, really?
It's been a long time since it's been that way. But still, you know, more girls than guys at that school. So it was a good experience.
It's like I don't know what the ratio was, but UC Santa Barbara – which, you know, was always one of the top party schools when I was in college. And I went to school in Santa Barbara, but not at UCSB. And there was the women, the girls there had to outnumber the men as well. It just seemed like no matter where you went, there was tons of girls and very few guys. So that's not a bad place to be.
Not bad for a heterosexual, right?
Right. That's good. Exactly. Exactly. It's pretty easy to choose there.
Yes.
So then what was your course of study?
So at first I really had no clue. I was still young. I started school right after I had turned 17. I started college and So I was super young, didn't know a thing. You know, of course you think you know everything, but you don't.
Right.
And so, you know, I just said, okay, well, study business. I didn't really know what I wanted to study. But a couple, my second year at college, took off for summer, lived with a girlfriend in Naples, Florida, and started my business there. I started a window tinting and detailing business, automotive, and basically put myself through the last couple of years of school. And so as I was studying business and I owned a business, I realized that what they were teaching was pretty useless. It was a lot of theory that wasn't practical whatsoever. And I'm pretty pragmatic. I want that practicality. So I'm like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. And at the time, the girl I was seeing was studying interior design and architecture. And for her first and second semester, I was doing the majority of her work for her, and she was getting A's off my work. So I swapped majors to that and basically put myself through the last couple of years of school doing that. And I excelled at it because it was something I really liked. So I never actually really used it because at that point, and when I graduated, I had already had my business for about 2.5 years at that point. And I knew I wanted to move back to Colorado. And I knew I really didn't want to go to work for somebody else at that point. And as an architect, you're pretty much obligated to go work for somebody for several years before you can then go out on your own and almost start over again.
Right.
And I didn't like the idea of that.
Right.
So I didn't really want to intern with somebody and do all that and go through that hassle. And I liked it, but I didn't love it. So it wasn't something I was really going to pursue. And I just decided, you know what, I'm going to find a way to start my business over in Colorado. And I had moved back to the Aspen area, right? It was pretty much as soon as I graduated. I graduated mid-December, and by Christmas, I was back in Aspen. So, and didn't look back. I was there for another 30 years.
30 years. And, okay, let's talk about that time in Aspen. How was it getting the business started there? I would imagine you were up against competition already there.
There was some competition. The fortunate part is the auto detailing end of things kind of gives you, the ability to bring in some day-to-day business, you know, without worrying too much about, you know, knocking on doors or doing anything like that. I was able to, you know, make quite a few friends around the area and, you know, get referrals from friends and start the business on a shoestring budget, basically. And within, probably the first year, I was able to put together enough money to really start the architectural end of the window tinting business. Which I was doing at the same time as the automotive end. So I was doing both, but I knew the architectural end was where I really wanted to be. It's where the money was. It was easier work, but it was harder to get into. So I knew it was going to take time to build. And so I kept the auto detailing end of things until 1999. And so December, I think it was December of 90 when I moved back to Aspen, and 99 when I actually stopped the automotive end of things entirely and just went strictly architectural.
Interesting. And the architectural, because I mean, windows in buildings are typically not curved. You know, they're plate glass, so it's flatter. And that's all being done on the inside, correct, of the windows, not on the outside?
99% of the time it's on the inside. There's still a lot of challenges with it. You have to understand the glass itself. You can damage a lot of glass by several means. You can scratch glass fairly easily. If it's a tempered glass and if it has some imperfections on the surface, you actually drag those imperfections across the glass and scratch it. You can break glass by putting the wrong film on that absorbs too much heat, and all of a sudden it expands too much compared to, say, an outer pane, because you're dealing with almost all double pane glass.
Right.
So, you know, you get some energy issues, you get some imperfections in the glass, you get a lot of things that, you know, people don't know starting out in the business, and they just, they say, oh, I'm just going to slap some film up there and get paid to do it. Well, you can do that for a while until you start running into problems. I had a customer, a competitor who did all the windows in an $18 million house and broke 90% of them.
Holy shit. Not while he did it, but when it heated up.
Oh, no. After it was already done, after it was already tinted, everything was done, 90% of the windows in the house broke because he put the wrong film on the windows.
And that cost him, or at least his insurance, if he had insurance.
Oh, he wasn't a competitor after that.
Right. File bankruptcy, leave the country.
Yeah, pretty much. So the knowledge base in the business is very, very important. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have surrounded myself with some really good people in the industry and learned a lot along the way. And I was able to, you know, get together with some of the bigger companies and talk to them about, you know, how to develop different films and, you know, getting on. We had a dealer council for one manufacturer who, you know, you'd get like seven dealers from around the world who represented the rest of the dealers around the world for that particular manufacturer. And I was on that dealer council for several years and trying to implement different policies and update policies and help them develop some of their marketing materials and help them work on developing different films and just get some good hands-on input, basically, is what they were looking for.
Nice. So I'd imagine there's like conventions to go to for that kind of business, or at least tied into with other things like paint or something.
There are, you know, I think I've never been to one of the glass, the glazier conventions, but I would imagine that there is some sort of, tinting aspect there. Typically one of the big ones for us is SEMA. You know, granted that's mostly automotive, but, it's all the same manufacturers of product. They're using their films for architectural. Now they are different films. Architectural and automotive films are different,
but they make it all. You're right.
They're the companies that make it. So you pretty much go to SEMA to meet up with those companies. And depending on what manufacturer you're with, they'll have national conventions at least once a year as well, kind of on their own for that particular brand.
And so for a Motorhead as well, that kind of kills two birds with one stone.
It does. Yeah. SEMA's a good place to go, particularly now that I'm only a couple hours away from Vegas.
Right. You don't have to fly in. So then, when did you get your feet wet in off-road? You said, you know, you had the 85 Toyota pickup and in Florida, did that truck go with you to Aspen?
It did not. I actually sold that about a year before I graduated college. I needed something fairly efficient. I got a little Honda Civic, CRX, you know, a little hatchback that I could basically put myself and my dog in and like travel around pretty easily, but it was sure hard to haul anything with it.
Right.
But it was, you know, it made the move with me out to Colorado. I started getting my feet wet and off-road not long after I got that 85 pickup. I didn't lift it right away, but, I kept going back and forth to Georgia and, you know, had a lot of friends who were into just going back on some back roads and, you know, different places. And it's the South, so really all you're really wheeling is mud,
right?
Which is terrible. I hate mud.
I agree. I'm right there with you.
Oh, just such a pain. Gets in everything and nearly impossible to get it all out. So, yeah, not my favorite thing to wheel, but it sure does make you learn how to find traction. So,
right. So then when you get to Colorado, you've got your Honda. And obviously, you're not off-roading the Honda.
It wasn't long before I got rid of the Honda and bought a Jeep.
Okay.
So bought a little YJ that I was able to at least run up and down the hills, and rented a cabin up on a mountain, and the Honda wasn't getting me there, so I had to have something, and we bought a Jeep Wrangler. Not long after that, I bought a 67 Toyota FJ40. So we could have a couple of vehicles to run around in. And, so I wheeled both of those for quite a while. The Jeep, just, local wheeling, stuff like that. And the FJ40, I started taking to Moab and different places where it was a little more interesting to wheel.
Right. And, when you started to go to Moab, how did you end up in Aspen and then with the Jeep, just, using it for a better commute vehicle, that you ended up going to Moab? What was it somebody said, hey, let's all go to Moab?
Yeah. I had a business next to, a guy who had a CJ5, that was somewhat fixed up, and he wheeled a lot, and he started talking to me about the local four-wheel drive club. Said, oh, I'd be interested in that.
There,
so
okay.
Went to a couple meetings in the four-wheel drive club and got to know a few people and started going down with those guys to Moab. And, one thing led to another and ended up president of the four-wheel drive club for a while. So
I know how that goes. That happened to me in Cedar City.
Yeah, it happens. But I was part of that four-wheel drive club for a long, long time and still very close to a lot of those people. And in fact, just had some of them come down this way a couple weeks ago to play around. So it's been really good to develop those relationships in the off-road. They're not as active as some of the other clubs, but they do a lot of trail maintenance up in the high country. They do a lot of, they work on a lot of land issues, keeping things from being closed, and they're active in that way, but not as active in the day-to-day wheeling world, which is fine. We need both.
Yeah, we do. We do. That's why I'm now part of the Rubicon Trail Foundation as a board of director. I'm trying to give back to that side of the of our industry instead of just the competitive side that I've been involved with for 25 years. So I understand. Yep.
In that particular area, the Aspen area, there's a lot of surrounding wilderness, and the organizations there are adamant about closing more. So the fight is real. And, we were front lines on some of that in that area. A lot of the Western Colorado stuff that they were trying to shut down, we were some of the ones that kept them from getting it shut down. They termed one of their closures that they were attempting hidden gems. And so we made up, little red circles with a slash through it, no hidden gems. And we distributed about 20,000 of those stickers, and everywhere he went, he saw those stickers. And guess what? They didn't get it pushed through. So we actually learned that we needed to work with them instead of a hard line against them to be able to be effective.
Right.
And most off-roaders, they want this hard line where, you just say, no, I don't want the closure. No, I don't want the closure. And you can't have that attitude. Look, I don't want the closure. You're right. But you can't be public about that. You have to basically, find a way to be diplomatic about it and say, look, I'm willing to look at this proposal. I'm willing to work with you on the different lands that you think you want to close. And in the back of your mind, you're going, we don't want any of it closed. We want more access. And so you've got to find that balance. And we were very effective with that balance in our fight up there, which is great.
Yeah, I've always been, I've not been one of those guys that you might call it pussyfoots around. The whole compromise to save, I have a real issue with.
And, so do we.
You know, and I get, you know, you have to find that fine line of cooperation without that compromise.
Well, it's basically a game. You have to play their game, whether you want to or not. And it's not about, for us, it wasn't about, okay, you guys want 1.5 million acres. We're going to give you 200,000. We didn't want to give them a single acre.
Right.
But we had to look at, you know, okay, what are the things that, you know, we can absolutely live without, and what do we absolutely need? And, you know, it turned out to be about 75,000 acres out of the 1.5 million that they wanted. And we didn't get trail closures, and we didn't get any of that stuff, you know, lumped into it. So ultimately it was a win for us.
Right. And Colorado's been a battleground state for land closures, and as well as Utah.
Oh, absolutely. You know, 100%. And yeah, I mean, they're beautiful places, no doubt. And, you know, unfortunately, there's user groups that don't really care for the lands the way that some other user groups do. And, you know, we're fortunate in the people we know, that we have a lot of really responsible friends who really want to save the lands and save them for the next generation to be able to utilize, whether that's motorized or non-motorized or whatever it is, but keep it open to everybody.
Right. Yeah, because once it goes to wilderness, it's closed.
You're done. Yeah, you know, you're absolutely done.
That
and
or
people
monuments.
People don't understand the difference that between or, wilderness that they see on TV, that, oh, Alaska wilderness, we can go in that. No, that's little W wilderness. That's not big W wilderness. Big W wilderness means closed off forever to anything motorized.
It, or even beyond that. You know, it's it's anything mechanized, let's put it that way.
Anything mechanized, correct.
And they're even going after the horseback riders now.
Yeah, so mechanized can mean a piton in the rock if you're a climber. You know, it can mean something as simple as that. Sorry, you can't use that little anchor in the rock because that's a mechanized piece.
Right, or your boat down the river.
Right, so yeah, that's it's a big deal. So yeah, that fight is ongoing. I don't think it's ever going to stop.
No, it won't.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yep. So then you get to go into Moab, and do you remember what the first trail you did at Moab was?
Golden Spike.
Golden Spike. Okay.
Yep, I do. That's, I don't know. I had, I think, 33s underneath my FJ40 at that time and some really stiff spring lift. And it was miserable. No lockers, but, you know, managed to get through everything just fine. You know, if you learn how to drive with no lockers, you can definitely drive with lockers.
So, correct. So, that's how I learned.
Yeah. Not enough people learn without. So, and still, you know, at that time, still manual and all of that. So, you know, three footing the whole thing and, you know, having a great time. So loved it. You know, a lot of throttle got me through some things. There probably wasn't a lot of finesse the first few times out, but it was still a lot of fun.
And, what is your most favorite trail of the normal Moab trails? And what I mean normal, the ones that are, you find in the books and everything, not the hidden gems that nobody, you know, not the Kevin Carroll type trails.
No, I get that. Yeah. I mean, for years and years and years, I was going down there for the main trails. So, you know, I know them well. And, you know, Golden Spike is great, but it's so long and it's so far between obstacles. It's beautiful, scenic, all of that. But, man, it's all day long and you're not really getting a lot of true wheeling in, not the way we like it these days. So, probably my favorite down there was Moab Rim. Just, you know, scenic wise, it's just beautiful on the Colorado River. doesn't take you long to get up and down that trail. You've got a lot of great obstacles on the way up and on the way down. So that was always one that, you know, I had to do, whether it was the Sunday morning we were leaving or at some point on one of the evenings that we were there or at night or whatever it was. It's just, it's a lot of fun and it scares a lot of people because it's off camber down towards the river on your first climb. But honestly, you know, it's, if you're careful enough and, you know, you're not doing anything stupid, you'll get through it.
Right. That's my, I think it's one of my favorite trails down there. That's for sure. Yep. The other is doing Pritchett and then to Behind the Rocks, but there's the one in between. I can't ever remember the name. Something Canyon. Not Fisher Canyon. It's anyway, there's that little trail in between the two, so you don't have to do the dirt roads.
Right.
And then when you come out of that, then you're up White Knuckle and then across. So yeah. So then
all good stuff.
Yeah. Sure. When was your first time to Sand Hollow?
So some of my friends went to the first Trail Hero, and when they came back, I was looking at their pictures and I thought, man, I have got to get down there wheeling. That looks awesome. And at the time I had my 67 FJ40. I had had several other vehicles. I built a, you know, Exo Cage linked Samurai, and, I had several other vehicles along the way, but I always kept my FJ40. And at that time, when my friends had come back, I was just finishing up a 10-year build on that FJ40, going to tons, going to, I don't know, probably the fifth V8 I had in the thing, but fuel injected and, you know, swapping sides on the T case and, I mean, everything, going to the automatic. I mean, basically going to 42s, linked suspension front and rear, you know, the thing was going to be amazing. I was basically
a buggy.
I was basically building it to be a buggy,
right?
You know, be a full bodied buggy. And so I was finishing up on that and they showed me these pictures. Man, I got to get down there. So immediately I booked a trip for winter 4x4 because that was the next event that was up. I was like, well, at least I'll get down there for winter 4x4. People can show me around, you know, it's a good event. I didn't know much about it. I just, you know, I looked it up online and I found the trails that they were running. And I was like, well, sounds like, you know, 9 rated trails is where I want to be. So we'll go for those and see what happens. And so we came down for winter 4x4 that year, and man, it just poured rain and half snowed that whole weekend. it was kind of miserable, but we had a great time. So, like, you know, when the weekend was over and, you know, we hadn't broken anything and we had some great trails, we did, I think we did Nasty Half, we did Joint Effort, we did the Maze. I don't remember all the trails we did at that time, but, several pretty good trails and, you know, a great group of people. And I met some people from Colorado on that trip that are actually living here with me now. So in Southern Utah. So we both decided after that trip that we might have to move there.
Right. And, a lot of Californians have done that too.
Yeah, I know that. But after that trip, we booked for the next Trail Hero and the next winter 4x4, the next Trail Hero. And then I took some friends from Glenwood Springs, where, you know, the Four Wheel Drive Club was. I brought them down to Sand Hollow and showed them around at some point in there before I had moved here. So, you know, got a good group of Coloradans together and brought them all down to show them around Sand Hollow for their first time. And they've been back several times since, so they love it too.
And then at what point did you say, okay, I'm loving this too much, I got to move here?
Well, I think I made the decision in early 2018 that I wanted to move. And I wasn't sure how that was going to happen because at that point, I didn't really have any prospects for selling my business, and I wasn't sure how that was going to go. I knew I could put my house up for sale. I wasn't sure how the business, if it would sell, if it wouldn't sell. I had no idea. That was all kind of up in the air at that time. But in 2018, we had a big forest fire that was only a mile or so from our house and coming our way. We had to evacuate, and that was on, I think that was on the 3rd of July or 4th of July. I can't remember that it started. And we had just had our house up for sale, and we were supposed to have a showing the next day, and everything got closed down. All the real estate sales got shut down for the rest of the summer. So there was no selling the house that year. And, you know, we had to wait till the next spring to put our house up for sale. So 2019, and it gave me time also to look for a buyer for my business. So that wasn't such a bad thing. 2019 rolled around, and I was able to put my house back on the market, sell it within, I think, about 3 weeks of putting it on the market, and also sold my business the same month. So we moved down in August of 2019 to Hurricane, and man, haven't looked back. It's been great. Made more friends in Southern Utah within the first year of living here than I made in a lifetime in Aspen. And I think part of that is the transient nature of Aspen. It's so expensive that people just can't afford to stay there. And, you know, I've been fortunate to make friends all over the world. My skiing career helped with that. You know, we haven't talked about that, but I'm sure we will. You know, I've got friends all over Europe, all over Scandinavia, you know, pretty much all over North America, a few in South America. So I've been fortunate to be able to travel all over the world skiing. And then as soon as I moved to Southern Utah, I quit. So I don't ski anymore.
So two hobbies can be very expensive.
Yes.
So let's before we get into the rock crawling competitions and stuff and how that all came about, let's talk about the skiing. How did you go from, you know, skiing as a kid to Florida, Atlanta, or Florida skiing as a kid, Atlanta,
then Florida, yeah.
Yeah, and then back to Aspen, and then you picked up skiing again. And you were just doing it as a recreational then?
Pretty much. So when we moved to the Atlanta area, because my parents both worked for Delta, we could pretty much fly anywhere we wanted to at a moment's notice. And so skiing, I never gave up skiing, even moving to Georgia. We would fly to Salt Lake was the easiest, just because you can fly into Salt Lake, be on the mountain in 45 minutes.
Right.
There's, you know, if you've got your ski gear with you, you don't have to go rent ski gear or anything else. You can be there really quickly. So it was super convenient. Delta flew into Salt Lake, so we could get a direct flight from Atlanta to Salt Lake, you know, be skiing, maybe just go for a long weekend or whatever. It didn't really matter because, you know, we weren't really paying for flights. We had to go on standby, but you know, typically you look at, okay, what flights have availability, and, you know, let's work around that and let's work around those days. And so my parents would take me out of school for a few days when all my friends were going to the beach for either, you know, Christmas vacation or spring break or whatever it was, I was going to the mountains. Right. And so I was like, oh, I'm going skiing. Sorry. And I'd come back with the skier tan, you know, goggles, you know, burnt face and the whole thing. And they'd be tan all over and I'd be white. but I didn't care. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, growing up skiing, I kind of always knew that I wanted to be a pro skier. I didn't know that I wanted to be a pro competitor. But I always wanted to do something in skiing. I loved it so much. And then getting torn away from it, just before high school, it gutted me, honestly. I mean, I found other outs. I found other avenues to compete and do all that. But it was just something that was always this burning desire in me to be able to ski. And so every year that we would go, say, Salt Lake, or we'd go to Aspen every once in a while and go back and see people and do whatever there. But I would work on a particular skill every time I would go skiing. So I would get there and I would work on, you know, a carving turn, or I would work on, you know, moguls, or I would work on something the first day I was back, and then kind of perfect that while I was there. And then the next time I would go back, the very first day, I would revisit that skill and then work on a new skill.
Nice.
And so every time I went back, I was working on different skills to be able to be a well-rounded skier. And I didn't know that I ever wanted to do anything with it. I just knew I wanted to be a better skier. And so, you know, that was fun to me. Okay, I perfected this skill. Now let's work on another skill and let's be better at what we're doing. And just, you know, I always wanted to be the best at whatever it was I was doing. So that was the goal. And, you know, it worked really well for me over the years. And every once in a while, being in Georgia and Florida, I would go to like East Coast skiing. We'd go to North Carolina. I'd have friends in high school or in college that would say, hey, let's go on a ski trip. And of course, I was always up for that until I learned what the skiing was like in North Carolina.
Right.
It was like, oh, that's terrible.
Like me, when the first time I went to, when I was in college, there was a guy I skied with named Dave Quinney, and his parents owned a ski resort in Utah. And he goes, hey, we're going to go skiing down at, you know, at Big Bear. And I'm like, Big Bear? Okay. You know, I grew up at Squaw Valley, Heavenly. You know, it was like, you know, I didn't even go to the little places around there, you know, like, you know, I mean, Kirkwood was steep enough. So that was okay. And, you know, in Tahoe area. So we went to Big Bear, and I'm like, okay, where's the hardest run? And they go, oh, this, we're going to go up on this run here. I don't remember the name. And we skied down, and I'm like, where's the hard run? I thought we were going to go to the hardest run. And they go, well, you were just on it. And I was like, oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah. It was kind of a bummer.
I had one of those experiences in North Carolina. I think Sugar Mountain, North Carolina. They said this one particular run, I think it's called Tom Terrific. They're like, oh yeah, that's the steepest thing on the mountain. And oh yeah, you got to go ski that. Well, I jumped the entire run. Right. Like, I launched off the catwalk at the top and I landed at the bottom and I missed the whole run. Like, well, that wasn't very interesting.
Right. I get it. I get it. Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, my first day when I graduated college and I moved back to Aspen, my very first day back skiing, I ran into one of my lifelong friends, one of the best skiers I've ever known in my life, and just super talented athlete. Ran into him on the hill, and he said, hey, they're getting ready to open up this particular run on Snowmass that's a, you know, super steep run. And you know, it was all socked in that day. You couldn't see the run at all, but it was waist deep powder. And, you know, I hadn't been in any of that sort of thing in years. And so I was like, hey, I'm up for it. Let's go for it. And, you know, we had to hike up to this thing and ski down. And I had no idea what I just skied down. All I knew, it was steep and deep. And I was like, well, that was a lot of fun.
I eventually saw it later.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. You know, and so that's the kind of stuff we would just go ski all the time. But, you know, having that person who, you know, could show me that stuff that was never available when I was a kid, that was not terrain that was ever open to anyone when I was a kid in that area. And they had opened up all this, you know, super steep terrain and off-piste stuff that was just phenomenal skiing, all double black stuff. But it's just, at that point, that's all I wanted to go ski. After I ran that, it's like, oh, that's, you know, I want something steeper. I want something deeper. I want trees. I want, you know, I want all this technical stuff. And so that's, you know, we always pushed it every time we went out.
That's what how I grew up at Squaw. I mean, I didn't physically live there, but we skied every weekend, and sometimes it was Friday through Monday. So I'd ski 4 days a weekend, but it was, you know, it wasn't the runs that everybody was on. We, you know, we would climb over the fences and jump the cornice. We would, you know, the signs that said, you know, this area closed or, you know, whatever, those signs became blank to us. And we just went for it, you know. I mean, oh, you can ski from Squaw Valley to Alpine? Oh, let's try right. that. What, there's a backside to Squaw Valley and you can come into the village from the backside? Well, let's try that, you know. And it was
nice.
We just went and hunted it. We didn't really I never hooked up with any locals. It was just the ski club that I was with, but it was you know, we got to the point where ski patrol would see us and they'd start chasing us. So they never caught us.
Yeah, I never got my pass pulled, but you know, there were times when I thought I was going to, for right. sure. You know, we would duck ropes and get into some terrain that, you know, only the locals knew. And, you know, fortunately I had my friend Franz, who had lived there all his life, and he never moved away when I did. And so, you know, he knew every inch of that mountain. And so we would just, you know, duck a rope and go find some really cool stuff and have a great day and, you know, duck the rope again and back onto the lift.
Yep. I think that I was in seventh or eighth grade. We went up to Mount Rose Ski Mountain it's near Reno, between Reno and North Lake Tahoe. And there was a van there, and, you know, were doing demo skis. And I looked over and told my parents, I said, I think that's Wayne Wong and Airborne Eddie Ferguson. And they were like, who is that? And I said, oh, jumped.
Oh, you got to know who Wayne Wong is.
Exactly, you know. So, and it was like after that first year of the hot dog competitions. I mean, it wasn't called freestyle. I mean, it was hot dogging. And so I went over like all the other, you know, kids and, you know, can we ski with you? Can we ski with you? And they were like, okay, this is what we're going to do. First run in the morning at this time, we're going to go up this chair. And if you get to the bottom with us, then you can ski with us. And I was like, gung ho. So I was, you know, I went up to the top of the mountain, waited for them to get there. And then there was probably 30 kids there and they took off down the mountain and I stuck with them and get down to the bottom. They looked around and, you know, I'm right there, you know, 20 feet behind them or so. And there was nobody else you could see. And they're like, okay, come on, let's go. And they taught me how to do a helicopter that weekend.
Nice.
Yeah, eighth grade, and I'm doing a helicopter. I loved it.
Very cool.
It's probably why my knees are bad now, though. bumps.
I think within about 4 years of moving back to Aspen Snowmass area, they had a speed skiing competition in Snowmass, and you know, as a kid, I followed Steve McKinney and CJ Mueller and all the guys who were setting records, basically speed skiing. And it was just, you know, I was in awe of these 8-foot long skis I couldn't even reach the top of. And, you know, oh, there was a pair in the corner at the ski shop. And so when they had this competition in Snowmass, I was like, oh man, I got to go out and do that. So I said, oh, I'm going to sign up. And I don't have any gear for this. I'm like, I'm going to run just downhill gear, but I didn't even own any downhill gear at that time. So I actually borrowed some skis from a friend of mine, some downhill skis, some 220s. And my boots did not fit in his binding. And so rather than re-drilling his binding, which I didn't want to do because they're his skis, I borrowed his ski boot and put my liner in his boot. Took up some of the extra space, you know, packed something in there to take some of the extra space up. And I borrowed a downhill suit and I borrowed poles, you know, like wrap around poles and competed in the amateur division and went like 97 miles an hour.
Wow.
I was like, man, that was awesome. And I got second place, which was pretty good for that, you know, my first time out. I was like, man, that was great. I got to come back and do 100, you know? So then it got to be all about the big numbers to me. So every time there was a competition, it's like, well, I got to go out and do 100 and I got to, you know, I got to try to do 110. Well, 110 on downhill gear, just it, you're not getting there. It's just not aerodynamic enough.
Right.
And so it's like, well, the only way I'm going to have this happen is if I step up to, you know, full on speed gear, step up to the pros. And so it was like, okay, game on, buy all the gear, you know, get some practice in, learn how to do it. And, you know, I had a friend in Aspen who at that time was a world champion speed skier. And he had a shop in Aspen, Jeff Hamilton, and he had the shop in Aspen, and he had all his speed gear in there. And, you know, his partner in the business was an ex-speed skier as well. And so I was able to, you know, get some pointers from him. And he's like, you know, John, if you really want big speed, you got to come over to Europe with us. Oh, okay. Well, you didn't have to twist my arm for that. And so I think it was 98 or 99. We said, okay, we're going to make the trek. And I traveled with Jeff that year, to Vars, France, and got up on the hill and started, you know, running, just running practice, maybe 120 miles an hour or something like that. And on those hills, it's nothing. Honestly, it's not hard to do 120 miles an hour. And so we're hanging out in this little French village in Vars, and we've got probably 2 weeks before our first competition. We've got several days to go up and practice. And I'm hanging out with this, this kid who's a speed skier in the village, and he knew I was trying to learn a little bit more French. And I grew up in a French family. Honestly, my grandparents were French. So I had heard a lot of French, but I wasn't fluent. I knew very little, but I had taken French in high school as well. So I knew the grammar part of it, put it that way.
Okay.
I didn't know how to speak it. So he knew I was trying to learn more. And on my way through JFK, on the way to France, I picked up a phrase book, French phrase book, and it on the cover, it said, even new phrases like mad cow disease. And I'm like, oh, okay. So when this kid asked, hey, John, you know, look in your phrase book, learn how to say something in French and try it out on me the next day. So we're up on the hillside the next day, getting ready to take my run. And I yell down to the kid, je pense j'ai maladie de la vache folle, which roughly translated means I think I have mad cow disease. And I gave out a big and I put on my helmet and I took my run, and I went like 130 miles an hour and everything was perfect. And I was like, man, I gotta do that next time. And so the next time I went up, I just gave out, I didn't say the words, but I gave out the big bellowing moo and I took my run. And it was a great run again. So it just became a habit. It's just every time I went up. And so all of a sudden, this, you know, this French kid that's living in the village, he's calling me La Vache Folle, the mad cow.
There you go.
And so the name stuck, and, you know, I got my nickname in France.
Nice. Nice. So what was the highest speed that you attained on skis?
153.1 miles an hour.
Holy shit. I did that fast once on a motorcycle.
Yeah, I've never been that fast in a vehicle, unfortunately. So I, you know, I've been close. I've been 143. But the problem is, you know, it's, you're basically on an open road most of the time. If somebody would put me on a track,
right,
I'm sure I could go, you know, whatever speed I wanted.
The Autobahn.
Well, even the Autobahn is limited. I mean, 150 is pretty much maxing out the Autobahn in most places. I've been probably 135 on the Autobahn, and it's, you know, you're passing a lot of people at that point.
Right. And hoping they stay in the in their lane.
Yeah, yeah. The Germans have this great system where if there's a wreck, they just pull this semi in that has a big gray wall on one side and the other side opens, and they shove everything into the semi and close it up and leave.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's super efficient. And work out the details later. They don't care. Just get it off the highway.
Right. So then what are some of the places that you skied besides France for speed?
For speed, we raced a couple different places in France. Les Arcs, France is where I set my record. Vars is where the current world record is set at 158 miles an hour. We raced in Switzerland, Italy, Austria. They're currently racing. I think they've had some races in Slovenia. They've had some races in Spain. We had races in Norway, Sweden, Finland. We kind of went all over the place. I mean, if somebody was putting on a race, you know, we had the world championships in Finland one year up in the Arctic Circle in this tiny little town of Sala, Finland. It's like 15 kilometers from the Russian border. It's, you know, crazy, crazy cold and not much daylight certain times of the year. We went up there for a training camp one year where you don't even race during the day, if you want to put it that way. You have about an hour and a half of daylight. And the light is so bad that you don't want to ski. You have to wait until it's dark. And so you run under the lights. And so you're running like 100 miles an hour in 20 below weather in a skin tight suit with no insulation.
Right. Cause that's, you're like shrink wrapped.
Pretty much. Yeah. They call it a rubber suit. It's not rubber. It's a four-way stretchable material that has a super thin fleece lining that's, you basically just sweat inside of it. And so that sweat turns to ice water real quick.
Right.
So then. Yeah. And,
You said your record, that was, you mean your personal best, or did you have a world record at one time?
I didn't have the world record. I had the US record. I had several track records. The world record was set in 2002 by a Frenchman when I set my personal best and the U.S. record. And then in 2006, I tied my record to the 1,000th.
Wow.
Which really pissed me off. but it was in the semifinals of the biggest race of the year, basically. And at that point, when the record falls, so my Italian friend who I had beaten, I was world champion in 2002, which was a points thing, just like NASCAR. You don't always have to be at the top of the podium, but you have to have a lot of the best finishes. And we have that in We Rock as well. You know, you don't always have to be at the top of the podium, but you have a lot of the best finishes and you're going to be national champion or whatever it is. So that year I think I only had two races where I wasn't on the podium that year, something like that. And so, it was a really good year for me and, you know, ended up world champion. Well, I think the next year, so 2002, I set my record. 2003, I was world champion. And then 2004, the Italian that held the world record, or set the world record in 2006, he started his world champion run in 2004. And at this point, he's still racing and has 13 world championships.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was happy that I beat him at least for a year.
So how is he able to do that? Is his technique just that good, or does, you know, is he got some secret with his skis and wax, or?
Yeah, I mean, the racers definitely don't give up their secrets on the skis. He's got great technique. He's a phenomenal skier. You know, he was a World Cup downhill guy for years and got hurt, and then picked up speed skiing. And you know, he's got great technique. He's a good overall skier all around, which I was fortunate to be in that realm as well. There's a lot of speed skiers who aren't great free skiers. They're very good at the technical sport of speed skiing, but they couldn't hit an off-piste slope to save their life.
Right. Okay.
I think that's changed nowadays. I think the guys who are at the top of the sport now are all good all-around skiers. I think it's gotten to that level where you can no longer just be a specialist in speed. So I think it started to change with Jeff Hamilton, but it definitely changed with me and with Simone, who's the Italian, Simone Aragone. And his brother set the world record. He set the world record. His younger brother set the world record after him. And so it's, you know, it's a great family legacy for those guys as well. So, but you know, I had a great career. I can't complain. I had a good 10-year career. Got to travel all over the world, got some great sponsors, you know, actually made money in the sport, which not a lot of skiers make money skiing.
Right.
Sponsors definitely helped with that. You know, I got a watch with my name on it, which there's very few athletes that have a watch named after them. So
there you go. That's cool.
Yeah.
So then you get the bug to rock crawl. And, did you move to Hurricane first before you competed?
Or did I did. You, okay. Yeah. You did. Yeah. I moved to Hurricane for a couple of reasons. One was definitely the off-road ability of the area. Just, you know, everything that the area had to offer off-road was amazing, but ultimately, you know, the decision was business. That was the primary decision. And, you know, being in Aspen, it's a very small community. Although I made good money, I knew I wasn't going to be able to scale the business to be able to retire there eventually. It was just too expensive and too small a place for, you know, scaling a business to be able to step back from the day-to-day operations. But I knew with the growth potential in the St. George area, Hurricane, all of that, scaling the business was a good possibility. I knew it was going to take some time, and COVID definitely slowed down our growth for the business, but it has been a really good place to grow the business, and it is growing at this point. And, you know, I'm super happy about the way that business is going, and looking forward to the future there. But because of COVID, I actually got a lot of four wheeling in the first year I was here.
Right.
So I social got distancing. 120. Yeah, exactly. I got like 120, 130 days of wheeling in, which was a great year. My best previous to that was like 37 days or something like that. So, I was having a phenomenal time, and I talked to, I think it was Steve Nance who asked me if I wanted to go compete. At one point, I think it was after that first year. I think it was 2020. He said, "Oh, there's a competition coming up in Cedar City," and I said, "Well, what's that all about?" And he said, "Well, you know," he told me all the details of We Rock and, you know, what I could expect. And I said, "Yeah, sounds like fun." So we went up and competed that year. I think we did two events maybe that year. I can't remember. I think that year they had the national championship in Cedar as well. I can't remember if I just went for that or we did two events, but, I think there was, I think that year there might've been the super crawl at Sand Hollow as well. That Jesse ran for 1 year. But anyway, that was, you know, we did a couple of events in, I had an SNN chassis, SNN Fab chassis buggy that I bought as a drag axle car and had Steve Nance at Santa Ana Off-Road rear steer the car for me while I was in the process of moving to Hurricane. I figured I was going to be down for a month anyway. So here's my car. Get rear steer under it. It's already got 40 spline rear. So, you know, use all that stuff and reconfigure it for rear steer. So, you know, had a car that was somewhat capable and, you know, we had a good time competing. David Binkert said he'd spot for me. He said he had some experience doing it. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And he became my spotter for several years.
Right. And then you guys, that was Sportsman, and then you decided to jump up into Unlimited and quit messing around.
We ran a partial year in Sportsman in that SNN Fab car, and then I ended up building a Caliph Redden chassis portal buggy, and we ran one more year. We ran a full season in Sportsman A and won the Western and National titles for that year. And it was super close, though. I mean, it came down to running up to Goldendale and competing against Michael Brassanini. And basically it came down to whoever won Goldendale was going to win the overall that year. And, you know, fortunately I came away with it, but it could have gone either way. Michael's a great driver and man, he gives me a run for my money every time we go out.
Michael is a good driver.
A really good driver. And I love just wreck wheeling with him. I mean, we go out and we push the limits every time we go out. So whether it's Sand Hollow or somewhere in Arizona or Colorado or wherever we go wheeling nowadays, we are always pushing the limits and looking for harder and harder stuff. And, you know, I honestly think the competitive side of the sport has made me a much better wreck wheeler. So I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, because you're first of all, you're doing things in competition that you wouldn't take that line unless there was cones there. You know, you'd always go, oh, hey, this line over here, a foot over here is much easier or much, you know, this makes more sense. But you have to drive the lines that the course designer, you know, and that's what I always called it. It was a chess match between myself as a course designer, the competitor, and then, you know, the playing field, the chessboard was, of course, the rocks. And so
And it is exactly that way. You know, you get into some situations where, like you said, you wouldn't normally try that line, but now you're forced into that line. You've got to find a way to make that work without either a rollover or hitting a cone or, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know? Let's see if we can do it without a backup, or let's see if we can do it, you know, cleanly, or, you know, let's see if we can even do it within the 10 minutes you're allotting us.
So you'd said in skiing that you were very methodical about trying or improving by working on technique or some kind of a skill that maybe you didn't have before. And did you find that you use that same concept when you rock crawled?
Competition wise, I haven't been able to really translate that so much, but what I have been able to translate is, you know, improving on different skills that maybe aren't intuitive, and things that I've learned in competition and I've seen other competitors do, or, you know, seen techniques that have worked. And almost every time we go out, even now it's, you know, 3.5-4 years later, I'm learning something new. You're going against guys like Jesse Haynes who have competed for the last 20 years fairly consistently. And they've gotten through all those learning experiences and they have all those tools in their back pocket. And I'm getting to the point where I have those tools. But I feel like I'm not quite there yet. I'm hoping that, you know, with a little bit more experience and now a newer car, I had a 2019 car from that was originally built by Jeff McKinley. That was a fantastic single seater Jesse Haynes Fab comp car. I was very, very comfortable in that car, but I thought it was time to upgrade. So I was ready to build a new car this year, and a car came available in California just 3 weeks ago that happened to be what I was looking for. All the same parts, all the right stuff. Unfortunately, it's not put together exactly the way I want it. And so it's not working quite well yet. So I will tweak it a bit and hopefully come back with a good working car and something that will be competitive the next few times out. But as of right now, it's still a work in progress.
So what does the future hold for John?
Well, hopefully beat Dave Wong one of these days.
Just about Dave's the time Jesse has his new car done.
Yeah, probably. Dave's been a great competitor and somebody I look up to in the sport for sure. And Dave and I worked together during the week. He used to own a window tinting business. I know you've had him on a podcast as well. He did exactly the same thing I did. We have very similar backgrounds. It's crazy how many similar experiences we have. And then we work together during the week. He helps me with my business. And then we go compete against each other during weekends and go out wheeling. You know, the weekends we're not competing. So it's been a great friendship. And, you know, I'm really happy for him when he wins. It's, you know, I'm happy for any of my friends if they win, and I'm happy if I win, but I'm not sad when I lose because I've learned something and I've had a great time during the weekend competing against my friends. So I think just more of that at this point, you know, hopefully get a car that's a little bit more competitive and, you know, push for the next whatever, however long, you know, I still love this sport. So I'm hoping that, you know, I can be competitive for another few years and enjoy my time just out on the rocks.
Right. And when that competitive and streak ends for you, when you decide, you know what, I don't need to compete anymore, and it's and you go back to the trail wheeling, it's still going to be there, that desire to trail wheel and push the envelope. And that's something you won't lose. I can tell you that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We have such a great time going out on the weekends or sometimes weekdays, you know, with Brian Woody Swearingen, you know, Dave Wong, Michael Brasinini, you know, there's a whole host of really great drivers in Southern Utah. Tyler Harper. I mean, it's, you know, man, you rattle off some of the best names in the off-road world, in the rock crawling world, and they're right here in my backyard. So we have a ton of fun, and I couldn't be happier with where I'm at and what I'm doing right now.
Awesome. And what would you say for somebody that's, say, running in Sportsman now, or maybe is looking to get into rock crawling competitions, what would your advice be to them?
Honestly, I think, you know, go out and do it. It is something that's a ton of fun. You've got a lot of people that are involved in the sport who will help you in whatever you need to do. You know, you'll get great advice from people. You'll get, you know, great support, and it's just a ton of fun. And whether you get out in just one of the, you know, recreational classes, if you want to call it that, the Sportsman A, B, or C, or if you want to step up to one of the full levels, you know, pro trail, unlimited, whatever it might be, there's pretty much a level for anybody that's out there. And, you know, if you're just a typical rec wheeler, man, come out and have fun and you won't be sorry. I guarantee you, you know, when I first looked at it, I said, oh yeah, that might be fun, but I don't know how much I'll really be into it. Man, did I get the bug.
Exactly. Well, John, I want to say thank you so much for spending the time today and having this conversation with me and talking about your life. I hope some people out there, some of your friends that you wheel with now, just learn some things about you. Of course, I learned a lot about you, and that's awesome.
Well, Rich, I definitely appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. You take care. And like I said, this thing will air. And if you'll share it, I'd appreciate it.
Will do.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks, buddy. All right.
Bye-bye. Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.